Are we ready for a post-NATO Europe? King Charles welcoming Volodymyr Zelensky to his Sandringham estate in images that evoke the days of Charles's grandfather when Britain bravely held down the fort before the U.S. entered World War II. Ever since, the continent had relied on Washington's security umbrella. That is, until now. What many call the ambush of Ukraine's president on live television last Friday came complete with what sounds an awful lot like Kremlin talking points. Trump and J.D. Vance blaming the invasion on Kyiv and NATO. That was enough to turn what was supposed to be an already solemn debrief of Keir Starmer's turn in Washington last week into a major brainstorm session Sunday in London. If push came to shove, would Europe be ready for a post-NATO world? And does Trump siding with Putin bring the continent closer than ever to a direct confrontation with Russia, something unseen throughout the Cold War? Today in the France 24 debate, can Europe go it alone? With us from Brussels, he's a former Italian EU affairs minister, today French member of the European Parliament for Emmanuel Macron's Renew. Sandro Gozzi, just back from Washington as part of a parliamentary committee that went to the White House and to Capitol Hill. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening, and thanks for inviting me.
Also with us, Anastasia Shapochkina, president of the Eastern Circles think tank, lecturer in geopolitics at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Craig Capitis, Europe correspondent for Newsmax. How are you?
Good.
You can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. History will tell how those 49 minutes inside the Oval Office last Friday are remembered. What is for certain is that they are unprecedented.
You're right now not in a very good position. You've allowed yourself to be in a very bad position, and he happens to be right about it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having cards.
I'm not playing cards.
Right now, you don't. You're playing cards,
Mr. President.
You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country, that's backed you far more than a lot of people said they should have.
Have you said thank you once this entire meeting?
Anastasia Shapochkina, have you been able to process what happened? Have Ukrainians processed what happened?
I think that for Ukrainians, there were split reactions, and Ukrainians understand that without the United States, they are going to lose a whole lot of support. The support, intelligence support, first and foremost, knowing when the Russians are going to bomb, knowing when the strikes are coming, they're going to lose weapons support, they're going to lose potentially also the support of aid. And this is very concerning for them. They are really aware of the importance of the United States. They have not yet... the U.S. has not yet been matched, you know, doubled. Basically, Europe would have to double the support that it's already giving, which is already more than the United States. And this is not very clear. And at the same time, I think that, of course, to every Ukrainian, seeing the humiliation of their president and also the suggestions afterwards that he should resign, even if people, you know, some people maybe think that he should resign inside Ukraine, but it's up to them to decide. And that's a very valid point that Zelensky raised later in an interview to Fox News. However, this looked truly just not only as an ambush, but also as kind of a sunset, I'd say, of American presence, of American geopolitics and of American foreign policy.
A sunset.
Mm. America is voluntarily getting up, going down from the stage of geopolitics and putting itself in the back row just to watch it.
Maud Kessar joins us now. Paris traffic could not keep away. The senior research fellow at INSERM, the Institute for Strategic Research, at the Paris Military School, L'École Militaire. You've been, I guess, speaking with military types and civilian types since Friday.
Yes, of course.
And what are they saying?
But I'm speaking also with my American colleagues, which is all the more interesting, I would say, in that particular moment. That is a turning point in American foreign policy, as Anastasia just mentioned. And what people would say, civilian, is that we should keep talking with not the U.S., but with American counterpart to get get to make them still in the process of discussion.
Including active military, including the officials in the Pentagon right now?
Including part of our counterpart at the Pentagon, of course, because they are our counterpart, and they are the first concerned with and engaged in the current war in Ukraine. And it's not only in the Pentagon, it's also in Europe, at the European Command, I would say.
Sandro Gozzi, last week there was the visit of Emmanuel Macron, the visit of Keir Starmer, and then the visit of Volodymyr Zelensky. You were in Washington, if I get the timeline right, before Friday. Did you see this coming?
Well, I saw the comment and I saw what happened in Washington at the White House, and I had the chance also to discuss this with the advisor of President Trump and member Republican and Democrat member of the Congress. And I think that it is a major mistake that Trump and Vance did. This ambush was disgraceful, and I think it doesn't really make sense, the policy, foreign policy line, if there is any, of Donald Trump and Vance, because it doesn't make sense to try to strike a deal on Ukraine without the Ukrainians, directly with Russia. It doesn't make sense to talk about European security without the Europeans. It doesn't make sense, you know, when you are in Washington, and this hasn't changed that much between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. I mean, the obsession of our American friend is China, is the competition against China, it's China's aggressive stance on the geopolitical scene. And I mean, and bashing like that, bashing as Donald Trump did the Europeans last week, if China is considered the main threat, doesn't make sense to me. And it is clear that there are provocations to which we don't have to respond, but we have to remain firm on our principle, and we have withdrawal consequences, that there is a major shift in the American foreign policy, and there must be, therefore, a major shift also on European security and foreign policy. But I mean,
do you agree with Maud Kessel's statement that, you know, that you have to keep those channels of communication open?
Certainly, you have to keep the communication open. Certainly, you don't have to respond in an aggressive way to a aggressive stance of Trump. It is clear that we have to explain to our American friend, as we did in our visit, that no, the EU was not born to screw the US, as Donald Trump has said. I mean, this kind of statement are totally useless, but it is clear that we have to keep a channel of dialogue, and I think that the work that Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer, supported by all the other European leaders, are doing is absolutely necessary, and I hope that will bear some fruit sooner than later.
Craig Kapitis, allow me to play devil's advocate for a second here. Donald Trump, you know, we talk about his transactional side negotiations, and we saw it during his first term, you know, threatening a lot of tariffs, and in the end, not so many were imposed. Again, is this all just part of political theater? After all, he concluded his statement by saying this will make great television. So are we making too much of this? Or is it, as Anastasia says, a sunset for transatlantic relations?
I think it is. I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to do two tours at the Harriman Institute years ago, work and report in Russia for many years, studying under what were known at the time as the wise men, guys like John Hazard, George Kennan, Averill Harriman. And one of those wise men was a fellow by the name of Chip Bolin, who was former ambassador to France and to Russia. And he said at the time, he said, what's public is propaganda, what's secret is serious. So let's start with that notion from a wise man who helped formulate post-World War II policy.
Yeah, we had an academic earlier talking about how surprised she was see diplomacy play out in public.
Does Bolin's observation work here? With Trump, I don't think so. Trump is all theater and performance art.
And so he's not ideological.
I don't think he would know how to spell the world word. What we saw was an American ally being bushwhacked by Russians on United States soil.
Come on, Russians?
Yes, yes. These were all Russian talking points. Now, there's a diplomatic aspect to this, and if the diplomats want to discuss this in their diplomatic detail, bless your hearts, but I'm not here to discuss therapy sessions about how to handle Donald Trump. There's a grave new world out there. We have U.S. senators like Mike Lee calling for the United States to leave NATO. You're looking at a soul-destroying tyranny at work in Ukraine, and if you think they're going to stop there and not come into Europe, well, then you are whistling past the proverbial graveyard. You have the odious apparatus of the KGB, operational here as well. Now, and what are we left with? Are you going to trust the Europeans to deal with this, with a KGB agent, with a war criminal who tried to blow up Chernobyl twice last week and send a radiation cloud this way? Are you going to trust him? Are you going to trust Donald Trump, who let 5 casinos go bankrupt, negotiate with him with a negotiating team who did not have a chance to study like you folks did? If that's what America wants, let him do it, because he's the president of the United States, and it's not going to change. So it's a grave new world out there. He's either impeached and thrown out, or something happens at the midterm elections. But right now, it's changed everything.
It's changed for good, Maud Kessel?
I don't think it's changed for good, but I think I would just jump in about what you said about the next midterm elections. It's already midterm election, and that's exactly the temporality.
It seems a long way away. It's November of 2026.
It's not. We'll see that perhaps tomorrow, because we understand that what happened with this theater or this TV show that happened last Friday was all about the next election as well. Here, Trump is always playing the candidate, not only the president. And he has his vice president, who is ideological, I would say, if
yes,
Trump
he is.
Is not.
Yes, he
okay,
is.
So just we have this, I would say, this particular ticket that is interesting in this turning point of U.S. foreign policy, that is reframing U.S. foreign policy. We knew about that. We have to be ready to respond to this new kind of dealing with transatlantic relations. And we have to be ready for that.
All right. Two kinds of reactions on this side of the Atlantic. Earlier, we showed you those images of King Charles with President Zelensky. The tabloids hail the move, with the Mail on Sunday going one further, asking the prime minister to uninvite Donald Trump for that unprecedented second state visit. Now, Keir Starmer, who's not yet ready to burn bridges completely.
Britain will play a leading role with, if necessary, and together with others, boots on the ground and planes in the air. Mr. Speaker, it is right that Europe do the heavy lifting to support peace on our continent. But to succeed, this effort must also have strong US backing.
Must have strong US backing. Sandro Gozzi, you agree?
Sorry, can you repeat, because I didn't hear the question?
Do you agree with what Keir Starmer just said, that Europe is ready, if needed, to put boots on the ground, but it must have strong U.S. backing?
Well, I mean, Europe is ready to take on its responsibility if and when there will be a peace plan. I think that certainly France and UK are ready. I hope, and we are working, they are working, to make all the other countries willing and ready to take on the responsibility to ensure keep a peace after the peace plan. But I think that we are confronted with a very clear reality. Your guests in the studio, they were very clear. I think that we have to accelerate the building up of a truly European military power. We have to take on our responsibility. It will take 10 years to become really autonomous, but I think that already now the litmus test for the European, for the credibility of the European, and for the future, for an independent future of the Europeans, I mean, the litmus test is what and how much are we ready to do to ensure a peace, the implementation of a peace plan. Then there is a lot of, in each capital, there is a leader who wants to be a bridge with the United States, with Trump. I don't think it's time for bridges. It's time for Europeans to stand united, to work closer and closer. And this is also, is this true for UK? I think that the future of the security cooperation, of security and military cooperation in Europe passes through, depends on a strong partnership between UK and EU, but we have to take to withdraw the consequences. I mean, it is time to become adult for security as Europeans.
And just on that point, Sandro Gozzi, on that point,
Emmanuel Macron has proposed this 2017. I think we had wasted a lot of time, and now there is no time to waste to go along this line.
All right. In an interview with Le Monde, the former French President François Hollande, Macron's predecessor, stating that the United States is a partner but no longer an ally. Do you agree with that?
No, I think that they are both. I think that we should treat them as part, as an ally, but it is clear that we have to become finally more autonomous. And also, and apart from the, I mean, from the shameful scene that we have seen at the White House between Vance, Trump and Zelensky, I mean, that is absolutely a shame. But I mean, the Americans are telling us to become more autonomous since Barack Obama. And since Barack Obama, the Europeans have always find an excuse to not go along this line. Now, I mean, now we are confronted with a major security crisis. It is time to act.
Anastasia Shapochkina?
The difference between now and the times of Barack Obama is that Barack Obama was not surrounded by people who have never read a single book on foreign policy. Obama was surrounded by experts on foreign policy and practicing diplomats. Barack Obama also hasn't started his term either first or second by disassembling the CIA and the State Department. But what I want to come back to is the meeting. I think that Trump trumpeted a lot about the end of the war that he wanted. But what he really wanted and what we saw this meeting show us was to get out of Ukraine. Mm. He wanted to get out of Ukraine. And that's a much easier goal to accomplish than to end the war. So he had just accomplished that goal. That his special operation has just succeeded, which plays, of course, perfectly into the hands of Vladimir Putin. The second point I want to make
just on that point, before you get to your second point, because it's part of the first point, which is that there's report in Axios that he's considering freezing military aid.
He is absolutely considering, because that's part of getting out of Ukraine.
So what happens then?
And that's what is just to kind of, I think what happens then is that the Europeans who have brains, when they see this, they don't see Zelensky. They must see themselves. Macron must see Macron. Starmer must see Starmer. Because they must see this and understand that American security guarantee, not for Ukraine, but in general, means something only when it is a useless piece of paper nobody needs to ever use. As soon as you have a threat at your door, as soon as somebody starts shooting missiles or sending swarms down your path, this piece of paper becomes good only for the toilet, and even then. And the smart leaders, they must see the writing of the wall. They must see that the moment they will need something from America, they will be in exactly the same position. Because from Trump's view, it's a very Cold War view, it's neither Zelensky nor Macron, nor Starmer, nor any other European leader is his equal. His equal is Putin. And personally, that's a big problem. I think nobody can jump is a psychological, truly psychological problem of deep and long-lasting admiration of Trump for Putin. Because for Trump, everything, all is moved by internal politics. And for internal politics, there is no better role model for him than Putin. He has really cleaned up that internal politics world excellently well. And Trump would love to be like Putin in every single way.
Just let me ask Sandro Gozzi about this. Just a quick debrief on your visit to Washington last week. You most notably met with the powerful chair of the A House of Representatives Judicial Committee, Ukraine aid skeptic Jim Jordan from Ohio. Your interlocutors, were they in admiration of Vladimir Putin?
Well, I mean, first of all, your interlocutor in the studio seems to say things different from what I just said. We are saying the same thing. We are saying the same thing. I just say that the Europeans have lost a lot of time building up a strategic autonomy. And now there is a historical major shift in the attitude of the United States of America. We are in trouble and we should accelerate. And I fully agree that the next in line is another European countries if we let Putin do what he wants to do in Ukraine. So there is no difference, probably in the tone, between the expert that you have in the studio and myself. But on the content, we fully agree. On the other issues, the message that Jim Jordan gave us was very clear, and we talk about digital issues. I mean, I don't know if it is true that they had the talking point from Russia when they met Zelensky. Certainly the new administration has got talking point from the big tech, from X, from Facebook, when they talk about digital legislation. And the message that, was given to us from Washington is that the Digital Service Act restricts freedom of expression, which is not true. We simply say that freedom of speech is not freedom of reach, that we need to protect ourselves from strong foreign interference. They consider the Digital Market Act as a protection attack against big American company, big American big tech, and they think that our path to artificial intelligence is totally wrong. We are very clear to our interlocutors. I mean, we explain that our digital law, are there to make our market more efficient, more open, to better protect our consumer. There is nothing against the freedom of expression. There is nothing against the American big tech. But this is a situation that I think there again, Without giving in the provocation, we must be firm, we are sovereign, we adopted digital legislation, we must implement them. And by the way, apart from the big tech, all the other representatives of American businesses, they say that our choice was the good one. So there is a very strong problem strong influence of four or five big tech on the position of the U.S. administration on our digital legislation. And, I mean, the reason why we are there.
So, Craig Kapitis, let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Because two views here in terms of, is it the Putin influence that you talked about earlier, or just simply the Silicon Valley influence on this administration?
Well, it's about money. I mean, I love this word, interlocutors. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go full tilt Boogie de Gaulle. Diplomats are useful only in fair weather. As soon as it rains, they drown in every drop. I see a lot of people on this panel, I'm not going to point to anyone, drowning in every drop. Now, de Gaulle also said the treaties are like roses and young girls. They last while they last. This is all about money, to your point of Silicon Valley. Okay? So what's needed to keep Putin at bay is money. Where is Europe going to get it? Now, I'm going to go full tilt Boogie again on Harriman Institute, where I had the good opportunity to study. And we were taught to think ahead five or six steps, cascade effects. Where is the money for us to buy the weapons we need from America to keep Putin out of Ukraine, keep him out of Europe, let him do whatever the hell he wants in Russia to his people? We don't care. Just stay out of our hair. Where is that money? It's in Norway. And there have been discussions with the Norwegians to tap into their $2 trillion sovereign wealth fund. The Norwegians don't like to be kicked around. To use some of this money, you could look it up. Mm. Some Norwegian companies have already said they're not going to refuel American military naval vessels that are coming into Norway because they're so fed up with Trump.
They were overruled by the defense
ministry. Yes, exactly.
Let them be overruled by the defense ministry. I'm telling you, this is real world stuff. Mm. Because these guys might just say, we're not going to fill your tanks. We don't know. So the question is, where does Europe get the money to hold Putin back? You want to talk diplomacy? please be my guest. But I think that's like a therapy session.
All right, Maud Kessar, on this point, the money issue.
On the money issue, so you've just tackled that issue, saying that perhaps the way that we would have to respond is by boycotting part of the current administration that is backed up by the big tech, because that was part of your question. And that's also what is at stake with Musk, Tesla, and what happened. And we have the figures of those few weeks.
Car sales down 42% in January.
Yes, you've just mentioned that in Norway, the official would not back up this initiative. But what about the people? Well, because all this discussion is about the public opinion, both in Europe and in the United States. If the European people are backing our political leader to stand against Putin and Trump, then it's going to be something else, because it's going to be the main issue for our European political leader, but also for American political leaders on the other side of the Atlantic, because they have to respond to the American voters, and what they have to respond to American voters is all about economy, inflation, and they have to. Trump wants to respond to American taxpayers. So let's talk about this.
How do you see how do you see European public opinion right now? Is it siding with Zelensky? What's your take on it? My feeling is yes, the Europeans are fed up with the Americans, but I haven't seen any surveys or studies. What have you guys heard?
The thing is, it's very interesting to note that we have a war fatigue about Ukraine, both in the US and in North America in general, and also in Europe. So we have to be very careful about that and about the sense and perspective about the conflict and about war. Because backing with Ukraine, when you think that is just a support for a humanitarian support, that's one thing. Then making your public opinion aware that you're going to be engaged in a war, because Putin is not going to stop at the Ukrainian border but wants to dismantle NATO. That's something else. And that's the job we have here, all of us, media, public media in particular, and intellectuals, academic. We have to make people aware of what is exactly the nature of the threat we are facing.
And one of the aspects of the nature of the threat is cyber attacks. And Anastasia Shapochkina, we saw the U.S. Defense Secretary announce a pause on offensive cyber operations against Russia. Again, the academic we spoke to from University College London earlier, surprised, first of all, that this was announced publicly, and secondly, that there's no whiff of a guarantee in return. There's nothing in exchange. How risky or dangerous or volatile is it?
I'm telling you, this for me is inscribing itself in the Trump's vision of America, right, which he had advertised broadly before the elections, which he's now very busy implementing. And the vision is to take America apart, brick by brick, taking apart the agencies, taking apart the leverage it had in the world, and including in the alliances. The seat is still warm.
But I guess I'll put the question differently to you. How vulnerable is Europe without the U.S.'s backup when it comes to the issues of intelligence?
Very vulnerable.
And
the Ukrainian experience shows very clearly that Europe is extremely vulnerable. Everybody's thinking, you know, what is going to happen if, let's say, the Department of Defense stops supplying the Starlinks, which Elon Musk is producing.
Which are these low-orbit satellite systems.
Which allow the internet to be captured in any area where there is no wire, you know. So this is not just the question for, you know, Ukraine, right? Everybody's looking at Ukraine, seeing this, and just starting to really feel the heartbeat, because, of course, stripping ourselves of that infrastructure, of that support, is going to be dramatic. However, I just want to come back to this point, how many years it was just... Member of Parliament, Mr. Gozzi, was just saying, how many years does it take to bring up to speed your own defense sector? It depends. Defense autonomy Turkey acquired defense autonomy in a matter of about 5 years after the US introduced embargo on its weapons supply to Turkey, after Turkey wanted to buy S-400s from Russia. Now, the US got its defense autonomy built up from scratch, from, you know, paper planes, pretty much, during 5 years of World War II. Now, India has been trying to do the same over the last 25 years because India is in no rush. China took its time to build its defense and to really muscle up. It didn't have any pressure, right?
So necessity is the mother of invention.
But you can do it in any time. You don't need to wait for 10 years. You definitely don't need to wait for public opinion.
Is it true, particularly since the Russian army is being degraded at such a
the only reason this meeting is happening and all these conversations happening is because Putin needs a break. It's not because America wants to end the war. It's not because Ukraine wants to end the war. Ukraine definitely has the lowest leverage, but because Russia needs a break.
All right, Mutko Kesal, let me ask you about this, because there's always a bit of fog of war. I've seen the reports last couple of weeks just how degraded Russia's military is. But is that stuff that's being whipped up by the Western camp? I mean, Vladimir Putin's got a wartime economy, which we don't here in the West. So he can just build more tanks, right?
I think we should be very careful, because we all know that Russia is backed up by China and that they need certainly a break. And during that break, Russia will have time to rebuild part of its capacities. So we have to be aware of that. And let me come back to this very interesting point that you make on cyber. In Europe today, we had this great discussion about nuclear deterrence. In the American mindset, you're also talking about cyber deterrence. What's happening here is a very a major shift if you compare with 2019 in particular, when the former Trump 1 administration developed its cyber command and developed its offensive posture. And in response to what in particular? In response to Russian interference in the election of 2016. So here we are attending a shift when the cyber tool in the end of Trump is posed. And we don't have this cyber umbrella anymore. I think we should integrate.
Well, that I have some
vision.
Bad news for you, Mo, because there was supposed to be
more of that.
There was supposed to be a launch of Europe's Ariane 6.
Yes.
This is the inaugural flight of a commercial, the next generation European commercial launcher. There's a launch pad issue, so it's delayed for 48 hours. The plan for this one is to put a French military intelligence satellite into space. For years, the continent's been at the mercy of SpaceX and Russia's Soyuz. So it's delayed another 48 hours. But I guess this delay, Sandro, I'll put it to you, Sandro Gozzi, this delay is, I guess, a symbol of just how vulnerable it is, because those French intelligence satellites, spy satellites, to put it bluntly, you know, the fact that it's...
I've been listening to you. Yeah. Hello?
Yes.
I have been listening to you. You have talked about many things. It was very interesting to me as a spectator to participate to your show. I mean, joke apart, you were asking me, be my guest, where is the European money? I tell you where we can find very easily and very quick the European money. First, let's use the Russian frozen asset to provide, to pay the security to Ukraine. Let's do it now. There are some legal uncertainty. We can do it now. So there is nothing to laugh. There is nothing to laugh. There is only one country in Europe which still has legal uncertainty on the feasibility to use the Russian frozen asset to finance security. So I think we should do it immediately. And there is a security crisis. We should use the same method that we used during the health crisis. The method that we used with Eurobond, with the European public debt, allow us in two months to mobilize 750 billion euro to respond to this crisis. And I think that we should do exactly the same, or using a very similar method, to raise immediately now the necessary fund to accelerate not only the support, the military support to Ukraine, but also to accelerate the building up of a military strategic autonomy. And this could be maybe help also to be more successful with Ariane in the next launch.
And let's go for a second, Sandro Gozzi, from Sunday in London, which we just saw, these crisis summits that we've seen in Paris first, now in London, to next Thursday. It's going to be a different game when you have a European summit in Brussels, because at that you'll have to invite all the Putin-friendly leaders, like the leaders of Hungary and Slovakia. You mentioned there doing doing borrowing plans. Is that going to be possible if 27 are in the room?
You are totally right. You are totally right. And this is why I don't understand why leaders, diplomats, security experts always say when it comes to defense and security, oh, please, but not talk about governance. Oh, please, don't talk about treaty revision. Oh, please, don't talk about using the article of the existing treaty to shift in foreign policy and security from unanimity to majority. It is clear that also the governance issue, money issue, is one of the issues that we have to tackle now. And why Emmanuel Macron took the initiative of asking to a willing group of member states of the European Union, to the representative of the institutions, to UK, to launch the initiative? Because he perfectly knows that if he had started in the ordinary procedure of the European Council with 27 member states, you would always meet an Orban or a Fico to block you. Now I think that we must show the political will to move ahead with those who are willing to move ahead.
So you think on Thursday there can be some kind of...
This is a matter of political will.
You think that on Thursday there can be some kind of successful outcome? There can be some kind of decision that comes out of that summit?
I think that we have to push for that. We have to do everything we can do for that. But I repeat again, yes, sense of urgency, but let's not forget the institutions. The EU is not equipped with this governance and this institution to face security and war. So we have also to change the governance of the Union. And every time there is someone that tells me, there are more urgent things to do, we have to do both. We have to do what allows us to answer to the immediate crisis, what we are doing, what Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer are doing. But once for all, we have to change the European Union, because in this new world disorder, the European Union cannot act as a credible defense, security, and foreign policy actor without changing the governance. So the two things must be done together.
Moutkessar, so that the viewer is not confused here, what are we looking at going forward on defense? Are we looking for Europe to have its own defense commission? Or are we looking for a NATO light? After all, we saw the likes of Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, attend the meeting on Sunday. What do you see as the most realistic outcome?
The most realistic outcome has to be thought about in the short term, because there's an emergency. And obviously, the NATO perspective and the European pillar of NATO I was talking about in the first place is certainly the best option, because we've been thinking about, not only thinking, but working on it for years. And what happened in London was not just the result of what happened last Friday, the TV show that we talked about in the first place. It's also something that was thought about in the long run, the Weimar discussions. Are put into the table. That's something that we're talking about between Europeans. Obviously, it's not the 27 we mentioned. It's the eastern country from the eastern flank, Poland, obviously Ukraine, the Baltic states, but also northern Europe. We mentioned Norway earlier in the discussion, and they are part of this move. And if the rest of the illiberal nationalist European do not want to move with us, we have to make a choice between values and economy, security, or it's what EU was built for, and it's also part of what the values that are shared among NATO members, even if big allies like the US would sometimes forget about those particular values. That's a problem of values, and we are about to mobilize the UK, even Germany, about that.
Yes, Churchill called it the courage to continue.
Exactly.
And that's what's lacking here. I think that Sandra's on the money when you talk about the funds that have been seized. But frankly, I don't see those funds being released. They should have been released a long time ago.
Whose remit is it to release them?
That's a good question, Francois. You know, my son was at a law firm this summer that was dealing with that issue, interning, and after 4 months there, they still didn't know. There were so many various tranches and who controls this, that, and the other thing, and even Bill Browder, who knows this stuff inside and out, I don't think even Bill's sure of it. So I don't, Sandro's right, you're right. But who's going to do it? Who's going to say, let the money go? I don't see that happening. It comes back to this courage to continue. I mean, what you're saying is absolutely right. Europe needs to take a leadership position here because Donald Trump is not part of our world here anymore. My job is to cover this world here. And I can tell you, when I cover it, they don't want to know about Donald Trump. He scares the bejesus out of everyone. Sorry, but that's the reality on the ground here.
He scares the bejesus out of almost everyone. We heard pushback this week from French far-right leader Marine Le Pen over the weekend. She said in a tweet that the European Commission totally goes beyond the boundaries of its remit when it talks about defense. As always, it uses a crisis to allot itself powers that belong to the member states.
Marine Le Pen, a long-standing member of the Putin payroll, together with her party. Yeah, I don't want to, obviously, spend my time discussing what her tweets. But what I want to say is that what Maud was saying is absolutely, I join her in this, that it's a choice, you know, between security and friendship with America. And it's very scary, you know, when you have, you know, when you're facing a divorce or you're facing in a high school, you're facing the total loss of a best friend. It's very painful. But have you ever met a person who divorced and then regretted it? It's never happened. You know, people who divorce, usually they are actually happier after the divorce than before, than during. And during the marriage. It is really remarkable. The fears of losing are usually more scary than the loss itself. And what we're going to be losing today
is not... So hang on,
are
you saying with NATO it's better to be from a broken home than to live in a broken home?
I think that unless, you know, Europe starts thinking now, you know, we know now, okay, America is doing everything to show that it's a new and reliable friend of Russia, one way or the other, that Russia can really count on it to represent itself in the Munich Security Council, to represent itself at the White House, to represent Russian interest in the UN General Assembly. This is a new reality. And we can still, you know, want to hang on to that dear high school friend. We can still want to go and have the fun with them. But they've just switched. They've just gone to a totally different crowd and they're lost for us forever. And the sooner...
Forever.
And the sooner, because it hasn't started with Trump, it has not been ever such an incompetent administration in place, but it hasn't started with Trump. The departure has started before, it's true. It's just we took so much time to believe in it because it was so slow. But now, we must react now quickly, because now we know that the cyber umbrella is over. The nuclear umbrella is just a piece of paper. It doesn't mean anything anymore. Otherwise, President Macron would not have to make that pronouncement that now France will guarantee a nuclear umbrella, because he realized, oh,
remarkable.
That is absolutely, we are like without the pants now. So, hey, you know, let's put some shorts on. And then second is that they realize that now that the whole, you know, even the vision of what democracy is over. And that was shared not by some, you know, Musk on tweet. That was shared by J.D. Vance at the Munich Security Conference. He decided to share his new vision of Europe. And that vision is Marine Le Pen and her tweets governing in every single country. And that is the new reality that we should react to only with defense spending increase. And that's not, I disagree with Craig here, that's not a point of the public opinion. Or was it Maud who was saying it? Public opinion to decide. It's really what you're saying later. it was for the elites to decide. And I know that in France they hate this word, but we are on an English channel, so it's okay. In terms of intellect, it was a political elites who must now assume their role. It's of course unpleasant for people to know that their money is going to go to making more guns. Mm. But hey, you know, this is also the economy drive. This is also job creation. Mm. This you can sell. This is technological leadership, which cannot be achieved without defense spending, because every single technological breakthrough, including the internet, happened only thanks to defense.
And we will conclude with Anastasia's wake-up call. Anastasia Shevchukina, yeah. Many thanks. I want to thank as well Maud Kessar, Craig Capitis, Sandro Gozzi for being with us from Brussels. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you.